Glenn Beck.
The Blaze Radio Network.
The International Fellowship of Christians and Jews is calling on all friends of Israel to show their support today. At a time when terrorism and anti-Semitism are at an all-time high, the Jewish people need strong friends like you who will proudly say, I stand for Israel. Go to www.ifcj.org/blaze to claim your free U.S.-Israeli flag pin today. Wear it as a strong symbol of your solidarity, faith, and resolve. ifcj.org/blaze.
In 2009, the President of the United States announced at a press conference in Turkey.
One of the great strengths of the United States is, although as I mentioned, we have a very large Christian population, we do not consider ourselves a Christian nation or a Jewish nation or a Muslim nation. We consider ourselves a nation of citizens.
That statement would no doubt come as quite a surprise for the founders like John Adams, who declared, the general principles on which the fathers achieved independence were the general principles of Christianity. I will avow that I then believed and now believe that these general principles of Christianity are as eternal and immutable as the existence and attributes of God Himself. End quote. The author of the Constitution of the United States, James Madison, said, quote, religion is the basis and foundation of government. End quote. Author, world-renowned historian, and founder of Wall Builders, David Barton.
Today, there's a push from courts and academics to claim that America was inherently secular in its origins at the time of its founding. A current book by two Cornell University professors seems to say this belief with its ridiculous title, The Godless Constitution. The founding fathers would vehemently disagree. George Washington, in his farewell address, said that religion and morality were our indispensable political supports, and that he would not allow anyone to call himself a patriot if he tried to exclude religion from public political life.
These founding principles were stated over and over again by most of America's founders. It was reaffirmed in 1854 by Congress. From the Journal of the House of Representatives, quote, the great, vital, and conservative element in our system is the belief of our people in the pure doctrines and the divine truths of the gospel of Jesus Christ, end quote.
And just as John Adams avowed that America was founded on the principles of Christianity, so too did many other founders. Noah Webster, who's responsible for Article 1, Section 8, Paragraph 8 of the U.S. Constitution, he stated that, quote, the religion which has introduced civil liberty is the religion of Christ and his apostles, and to this we owe our free constitutions of government, end quote.
And by the United States Supreme Court in 1892, in the case of the Church of the Holy Trinity versus the United States, when the highest court in the land ruled, quote, from the discovery of this continent to the present hour, there is a single voice making this affirmation, that this is a Christian nation, end quote. In today's society, the prevailing theory among progressives is that the Supreme Court rulings are, quote, settled law, end quote. Does that only apply to rulings with which they agree? In 1905, one of the justices of that court, Supreme Court Justice David Brewer, explained the ruling further in his book, The United States, a Christian Nation. He wrote that, quote, the Christian duty of citizens in America is to ensure the advancement of the nation under biblical and Christian principles, end quote. He further argued that, quote, civilization is dependent on the advocacy of Christianity, and the degree that citizens are willing to advocate these principles to the degree that they and the nation will be blessed, end quote. Finally, Justice Brewer argued that the world will be blessed, not primarily through material advances, but through allegiance to the principles of Christ that transforms the individual, the family, the nation, and the world. Still, coming as they did from a place where the citizens had to belong to the official state religion, where people could be fined or even jailed for not paying tithes to the state religion or attending services on the Sabbath, religious freedom was so paramount to them that the founders made it the first principle in the First Amendment of the United States Constitution, even before freedom of speech. The Establishment Clause states very simply but eloquently, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Period. That's it. in its entirety. It says nothing about favoring, granting equal time to, not displaying religious symbols or praying in public or on government property, including schools. What it does say is that Congress cannot pass a law that establishes a state religion, nor can the government or anyone else force others to worship in a certain way. That is why the United States became the first nation in history to abolish religious disqualifications from office holding and civil engagement. They wanted to make sure that if you were Jewish or Muslim or atheist, you could still serve, and there would be no penalty for not adhering to a certain religion. It did not mean that America was not founded on Christian Judeo principles. It clearly was.
And Declaration signer Benjamin Rush likewise declared, quote, "I have always considered Christianity as the strong ground of republicanism," end quote.
In 1800, Congress approved the use of the Capitol building as a church. Both chambers approved the measure with the president of the Senate, Thomas Jefferson, giving the approval in that chamber.
So, with such historical documents, no wonder President Harry Truman declared, "This is a Christian nation." And by the way, even Woodrow Wilson agreed that, quote, "America was born a Christian nation," end quote.
What about the separation of church and state, some say? That is not contained in the Constitution, but it was a phrase written by Thomas Jefferson. Throughout his terms as both vice president and president, Jefferson attended church at the Capitol, including January 3, 1802, just 2 days after writing his infamous letter in which he penned the phrase, "the wall of separation between church and state," to a Baptist minister in Connecticut.
The U.S. Capitol building in Washington, D.C. was completed in November of 1800, and on December 4th of that year, Congress decided to use the largest room in the Capitol, the Hall of the House of Representatives, as a location for weekly Sunday worship services at the Capitol. Now, the fact that the Capitol was available for church services on Sunday was due to the Article 1, Section 7 constitutional requirement that forbade federal lawmaking on Sundays. And by the way, this recognition of a Christian Sabbath in the U.S. Constitution was long cited by federal courts as proof of the Christian nature of America.
This fact alone shows how misguided the claims of this wall of separation are. Thomas Jefferson meant that there should never be a state religion that would prevent Baptists or anyone else from worshiping as they saw fit. The Establishment Clause was a protection for religion. It was never intended as a protection for the state from religion. The fact is, the first act of the first Congress on this continent was a call for prayer on September 6, 1774, and an invitation to a pastor to offer the prayer. On May 16, 1776, the Continental Congress appointed an official National Day of Fasting and Prayer for the colonies. The proclamation read,
"The Congress, desirous to have people of all ranks and degrees duly impressed with a solemn sense of God's superintending providence and of their duty devoutly to rely on His aid and direction, do earnestly recommend Friday, the 17th of May, to be observed by the colonies as a day of humiliation, fasting, and prayer, that we may, with united hearts, confess and bewail our manifold sins and transgressions, and by sincere repentance and amendment of life appease God's righteous displeasure, and through the merits and mediation of Jesus Christ, obtain His pardon and forgiveness."
The Continental Congress on September 11, 1777, ordered the importation of 20,000 Bibles for the American troops. The cash-strapped, in fact, nearly bankrupt Continental Congress saw fit to spend what meager funds they had on obtaining 20,000 Bibles and put them into the hands of U.S. troops in their fight against Britain. That sounds like the actions of a Christian nation.
Congress, after having approved the importation of Bibles, later decided to do something more. Under British law, it had been illegal to print English Bibles in America. Great Britain had a state-established church, and so it decided what Bibles we could and couldn't use. But with the American Revolution and America becoming free, we could now print Bibles here in America. So in 1781, Robert Aiken, the official printer to the Continental Congress, He petitioned Congress for permission to print Bibles on his presses right there in Philadelphia where Congress was located. He explained to Congress that his new Bible would be, quote, a neat edition of the Holy Scriptures for the use of schools, end quote. And Congress approved a congressional committee to watch over the project. In 1782, that Bible received the full approval of the full Congress and soon began rolling off the presses, and it had a congressional endorsement printed in the front of that Bible. It's now known as the Bible of the Revolution, and it was the first English language Bible printed in America. One early historian observed, quote, who will call in question the assertion that this is a Bible nation? Who will charge the government with indifference to religion when the first Congress of the states assumed all the rights and performed all the duties of a Bible society long before such an institution had an existence in the world? It was not until 31 years later the signer of the Declaration of Independence, Benjamin Rush, formed the nation's first Bible society. But decades before, Congress itself had led the way for Bibles in America.
The indispensable man. The man without whom America would not exist, and the only leader ever to be unanimously elected to the office of president twice, George Washington, in his farewell address, summed up his gratitude to the Lord for his blessings on America this way. Whereas it is the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God, to obey his will, to be grateful for his benefits, and humbly to implore his protection and favor. Now, therefore, do I recommend that we might all unite in rendering unto him our sincere and humble thanks for his kind care and protection, and also that we may then unite in most humbly offering our prayers and supplications to the great Lord and ruler of nations, and beseech him to pardon our nation and other transgressions, to promote the knowledge and practice of true religion and virtue, end quote. Does that sound neutral? Does it sound irreligious to anyone? And how do you think the network news organization would respond to this speech from George Washington to Delaware Indian chiefs in June of 1779? Quote, you do well to wish to learn our arts and our ways of life, and above all, the religion of Jesus Christ. These will make you a greater and happier people than you are. Congress will do everything they can to assist you in this wise intention, end quote. Fortunately, the Freedom From Religion Foundation was still 199 years away from its formation, or Washington may still be involved in trying to clear up the lawsuits resulting from that speech. In the next episode, we explore what Christians around the world are enduring today.
Glenn Beck.
This is the Glenn Beck Program.
America was founded in large part because of the desire for religious freedom. But it's been 225 years since ratification of the United States Constitution, and now, with the passage of centuries, Americans sometimes take the freedoms they've enjoyed for granted, since they've always had them. There has never been a time in the lives of any American when they didn't have the protection of the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment. It is the first right spelled out in the First Amendment of the document that many Americans still hold dear. Most of the rest of the world, however, can only dream of being able to take such a right for granted. Communism in general has never been friendly to religion, especially Christianity. The communist purge of Christianity began almost immediately with the Bolshevik Revolution of 1918. The once thriving Catholic Church in Russia was all but annihilated after the communist takeover. Atheism became the official state religion. Catholic institutions were dissolved by the Soviet Union, and its property was confiscated under Lenin. And then it got worse under Stalin.
It was not just churches that Stalin destroyed. Millions were carted away to the dreaded Gulag camps. Millions more executed. Every man who had signed the last Tsar's death warrant died by a bullet. Stalin's enemies included anyone who could remember what happened. Like history itself, they were erased.
Between the Soviet Union and the Communist Revolution in China, Christianity was all but wiped off the Asian continent. A fact that may surprise some, even though they used Christianity at first to further their goals, German Nazis planned to eliminate Christianity from the beginning of their movement, just as they did Jews and Judaism. The Nazi leader of the German Youth Corps, which would later be known as the Hitler Youth, said, "The destruction of Christianity was explicitly recognized as a purpose of the National Socialist movement from the beginning, though, quoting still, considerations of expedience made it impossible for the movement to adopt this radical stance officially until it had consolidated power." Pastor Martin Niemöller, who would later write the famous "First They Came for the Jews" poem, became outspoken against state control of Protestant churches in 1937 and was arrested. When a judge acquitted him as he left the court, he was arrested again, this time by the Gestapo, and sent to a concentration camp where he remained until the end of the war. Most people don't think of that type of persecution as continuing to exist in the world today, except perhaps in the Middle East. But today, in communist North Korea, a nation of 26 million people, there are only 300,000 Christians. Persecution of Christians is worse there than in any other nation on earth, including Islamic countries where ISIS has a significant presence. The persecution of Christians in North Korea is so bad that no one actually knows the exact number of Christians there, as most of them remain silent about their belief. And in fact, parents often refrain from even teaching their beliefs to their children to avoid the possibility that their kids might let something slip out about their family's faith around strangers. Admitted Christians and atheists in North Korea are arrested and sent to prison camps. Some 50 to 70,000 North Korean Christians are now suffering torture and horrific living conditions every day in North Korean labor camps. In China, today, there are believed to be 67 to 100 million Christians in a nation of 1.4 billion people. Christianity there is thriving despite serious persecution, whereas the number of faithful Christians is diminishing in many parts of the world where there is no threat. The number of the faithful in China is growing rapidly. Proselytizing is illegal in China, yet it's believed that by the year 2030, less than 15 years from now, there will be more than 250 million Chinese Christians. Christians, Buddhists, and Muslims can technically worship as they see fit in China, but in reality, they can only worship on the government's terms. Christians must limit themselves to normal religious activity at the state-backed church. But Communist Party dogma always supersedes religious doctrine, and local party officials decide what "normal," end quote, means and what is legal. Churches can be closed and Christians arrested for almost anything that runs afoul of the local Communist Party leader's whims. So Christians, as well as members of other faiths, usually go about their religious practices very quietly, without drawing attention to themselves. The United States government in past has urged Chinese leaders to be more tolerant of worshipers, to which the Chinese shot back last October, telling U.S. leaders to, quote, "stop acting like an international religious police force," end quote. Christians living in Muslim-dominated countries like Iraq and Syria are, of course, under siege as well. Right now, the biggest threat is coming from the terrorist organization ISIS.
They said for Christians, either pay a fee, be Muslims, or otherwise be killed if they don't flee Mosul. When we arrived at the checkpoint, more than 50 members of ISIS were waiting for us. They said, Nasrani people, meaning Christians, you are welcome. Either we butcher you now, or you become Muslims. They took every single thing we had. They didn't even leave one dinar.
ISIS has caused a vast humanitarian crisis in the Middle East. Christians and Muslims alike are fleeing for their lives. In Iraq, where in 2003 there were some 2 million Christians, There are now only an estimated 180,000. Over 90% of the entire Christian population gone. In the city of Mosul, 100,000 Christians fled their homes in one night.
For the first time in nearly 2,000 years, there are no Christians left inside Mosul.
They take everything from us, but they cannot to take the God from our hearts. They cannot.
During this carnage, Christian girls have been abducted and used as sex slaves for terrorists. In many cases, living conditions for the Christians who have fled have been shocking, with entire families at times taking up residence in shipping containers. Open Doors is an agency that serves persecuted Christians around the world. Each year, they compile a list of the countries where persecution is the worst in the world.
In 2016, Iraq has moved to number 2 on the list. Iraq has seen tens of thousands of Christians forced to flee their homes because of the terror of ISIS. Many have been displaced for over a year now, burdened with the struggle of daily living as they face an uncertain future. Eritrea, ranked number 3, has had one of the most dramatic jumps in rank. Christians suffer intense persecution in all spheres of life. Believers face violence and imprisonment in horrific conditions, some being locked inside metal shipping containers. Uzbekistan, ranked at number 15, has one of the harshest dictatorships in Central Asia. Because of the constant pressure and surveillance, it is almost impossible for Christians to display or share their faith.
With so much going wrong that needs to be righted, with Christians being displaced by the millions, murdered by the thousands, abused, crucified, and used as sex slaves, what has the President of the United States chosen to focus on?
And lest we get on our high horse and think this is unique to some other place, remember that during the Crusades and the Inquisition, people committed terrible deeds in the name of Christ. In our home country, slavery and Jim Crow all too often was justified in the name of Christ.
He deflected attention from what is actually taking place right now to debatable historic events from 1,000 years ago in Europe and the Middle East. Instead of focusing on the plight of Christians now, the president chose to cast blame on Christians for deeds in the long distant past. All of which sets the stage for our look at what is taking place today, here in America, and whether those religious freedoms we enjoy and cherish, and which protect us from the horrors elsewhere, can and will endure.
Glenn Beck.
Since the ratification of its founding document, Americans have always been able to count on their number one God-given freedom. It is the first of all rights, spelled out at the very beginning of the United States Constitution. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. It is positioned at the beginning of the First Amendment for a reason. It is the most important. It is sacrosanct. Until recently, the 1962 Supreme Court ruling that praying in school was unconstitutional set the stage and began the assault on America's religious freedom. Interestingly, children saying prayers in school does not and cannot qualify as Congress making a law to establish a religion. But it certainly could be interpreted as prohibiting the free exercise thereof. Yet, that somehow was not the determination made by the Earl Warren-led Supreme Court. For religious freedom in America, the ruling was a significant turning point. Another was the presidential election of Barack Obama in 2008. He brought a new attitude to the executive branch of the government in the United States.
Whatever we once were, we are no longer a Christian nation.
It was an attitude that stunned many Americans who knew that America, in fact, was founded on Christian Judeo principles. His understanding, or lack thereof, concerning the scriptural passages, context, culture, and frame of reference also shocked many believers.
Which passages of scripture should guide our public policy? Should we go with Leviticus, which suggests slavery is okay, and that eating shellfish is an abomination? Or we could go with Deuteronomy, which suggests stoning your child if he strays from the faith? Or should we just stick to the Sermon on the Mount, a passage that is so radical that it's doubtful that our own Defense Department would survive its application?
No American president has ever been so brazen in his disdain for the Bible. With the passage of the hallmark legislation of his presidency, Obamacare, President Obama would go head-to-head against the Catholic Church and other religious organizations. There is a provision in the Affordable Health Care Act that orders health insurance providers to provide sterilizations, contraceptives, and abortion-inducing drugs to all female beneficiaries. There is an exception for those insured by religious employers, which only includes the actual houses of worship, their immediate auxiliaries, associations of houses of worship, and the exclusively religious activities of any religious order. So religious hospitals, universities, and charities are not exempt from the order. Because they are a Christian, family-owned business, Hobby Lobby refused to provide abortion pills as part of their employees' health care coverage, as mandated by Obamacare. As a result, they faced fines of $1.3 million per day. Hobby Lobby held firm and appealed all the way to the Supreme Court, who eventually ruled 5-4 in their favor.
Today, the High Court striking down a key provision in the Affordable Care Act that requires for-profit companies to provide comprehensive birth control coverage. The main plaintiff, the evangelical Christian owners of Hobby Lobby craft stores, challenged the law, saying it violated their religious beliefs.
In October 2015, the nonprofit legal organization called Alliance Defending Freedom, ADF, filed a complaint against the state of California. It had a serious issue with a state law mandating that pro-life medical centers in the state post notices with information of where to go for free or low-cost abortion and contraception services. No such law exists for clinics like Planned Parenthood, who offer abortions. The pro-life clinics offer services like pregnancy tests, ultrasounds, counseling, and access to donated baby goods like diapers and maternity clothes. Their purpose is to provide moral and material support for pregnant women, thus encouraging them to carry their babies to term. The executive director of one such facility said, "A sign in the lobby is not how or when I want my clients at the clinic to hear about abortion. It goes against everything my clinic stands for," end quote. Another clinic worker put it this way, quote, "It's like telling Alcoholics Anonymous group that they have to have a large sign saying where people can get booze for free." In 2015, Barack Obama announced the Supreme Court's landmark decision on same-sex marriage.
"This morning, the Supreme Court recognized that the Constitution guarantees marriage equality. In doing so, they've reaffirmed that all Americans are entitled to the equal protection of the law."
Even before that decision, people of faith were being forced to participate in an event that they felt violated their faith. Aaron and Melissa Klein, devout Christians who live in Oregon, were sued for $135,000 for choosing not to bake a cake for a lesbian couple's wedding, even though at the time gay weddings were illegal in Oregon. The Kleins had sold the couple baked goods on several occasions prior to being asked to make the wedding cake, but simply felt the participation in a same-sex ceremony would not be in keeping with their faith. The Kleins lost their court battle and their bakery. While appealing the case, the state seized all of the Kleins' bank accounts. They have since paid the couple over $136,000 for not baking them a cake, even as they continued their appeal process. Others have been similarly sued for declining to participate in same-sex marriages, including New Mexico photographers who took their case all the way to the United States Supreme Court. But the court refused to hear their case, so the lower court verdict against them stood. And a couple in New York who have a wedding and reception venue on their farm, who were ordered to allow a lesbian couple to hold their wedding on their property. The couple said they could hold the reception at their farm, just not host the wedding ceremony itself. But that wasn't good enough. They were fined $13,000, and in addition to the fines, New York State is forcing them to teach classes to their employees that impose the state's view of marriage. The couple has since decided to stop doing all wedding ceremonies on their property. In 2014, the CEO of internet browser Mozilla, Brendan Eich, was essentially fired from his job because it came to light that 6 years earlier, he had donated money to California's Prop 8 movement, which mandated marriage in the state constitution as being between one man and one woman. It seems when it comes to practicing faith, there has been a tectonic shift in America. Wisconsin Senator Tammy Baldwin shared her belief that the First Amendment does not extend much beyond the walls of your local church.
Certainly the First Amendment says that in institutions of faith, that there is absolute power to, you know, to observe religious, deeply held religious beliefs. But I don't think it extends far beyond that.
In actuality, of course, the First Amendment says absolutely nothing at all about institutions of faith. It simply says the right to freely exercise faith shall not be prohibited. The head of the Democratic National Committee, Debbie Wasserman Schultz, seemed to back up what Senator Baldwin was saying. That, much like Second Amendment opponents believe that the amendment is about militias' right to bear arms, not individuals, now some high-profile Democratic Party leaders are asserting that the right to religious freedom is for a church and organizations, and not the individual, as she says in this interview with CBN.
The distinction is more as it relates to churches and religious groups.
If you're a legitimate religious institution, and don't misunderstand my term legitimate, but if you're a church, if you're a church affiliated, I mean by church, I mean synagogue, church.
Right.
If you're a religiously affiliated organization, then you have wider latitude in terms of the Constitution and the protections that are, you know, First Amendment provides.
But freedom of religion is increasingly under fire even within the walls of our own houses of worship. In Houston, Mayor Anise Parker and the city council had passed an ordinance that would allow transgendered persons to use whatever public bathroom they chose. The ordinance was opposed by some local pastors. Five of them had their sermons subpoenaed by the mayor and city council. But it wasn't just their sermons. It was all speeches, presentations, or sermons related to the ordinance, the petition, Mayor Anise Parker, homosexuality, or gender identity prepared by, delivered by, revised by, or approved by you or in your possession. End quote. Perhaps realizing that her subpoena order would have been more acceptable had it been issued by the KGB in Stalingrad than the City Council of Houston, Texas, Mayor Parker eventually dropped her demand in the face of enormous public outcry. For now, Americans have fought off some of the worst efforts to erode religious liberty, but also have incurred some serious setbacks. The attitude in many in leadership positions should serve as a wake-up call to those who are dedicated to preserving the God-given rights the founding fathers and those who came after them fought so hard and gave so much for.
You're listening to the Glenn Beck Program.
Today, we're going on a journey. They say that time itself does not exist as we know it, as we understand it. It only really exists as something called space-time. It's really only a point on a giant map. Something that we can use to find out where we are, where we've been, or where we're going. So let's unfold space-time and trace our way back. First, maybe just a couple of years.
Tonight, I can report to the American people and to the world.
The United States has conducted an operation that killed Osama bin Laden, leader of Al-Qaeda.
On my order, the United States military has begun strikes
against Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps.
The people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
Now back even further.
Princess Diana died.
I did not have
this vast right-wing conspiracy.
Right now, he is O.J. Simpson. He is armed with a gun.
Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this.
Elvis Presley died today.
Well, I'm not a crook. I've earned everything I've got.
Because of what has happened in Munich during the past 48 hours,
8 or 9 terrified living human beings are being held prisoner.
One small step for man.
A second shot, the third total shot, hit the president's head.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Beatles!
Dr. Martin Luther King has been shot to death in Memphis.
A short time ago, an American airplane dropped one bomb on Hiroshima.
Allied naval forces, supported by strong air forces, began landing Allied armies this morning on the northern coast of France.
December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy.
Oh, the humanity!
Back farther still, even before Marconi, when the air was silent. Back past the signing of the Declaration of Independence, past the Age of Enlightenment, before Martin Luther hung his protest on the church doors, before Columbus rediscovered the fact that the world was round. We go past Newton, Galileo, the Dark Ages, the Crusades, back to a time before books, when most of the world couldn't read nor write, and history was oral. We leave this world now, where we can hear and see a lone protester standing in front of a tank in a country on the other side of the planet, and we can see it live. To a world seemingly simple, yet brutal beyond our understanding, where news was spread from mouth to mouth. We stop here, at approximately 29 of the Common Era. We stop at a small walled city in the Middle East. It's around 10 o'clock at night, just a couple of days before Passover. The meals are being prepared, the night's meal had already been eaten, and most in the city are asleep. One man, however, is not. It's strange. He's younger than I am. He's about 30. He's awake and alone in a garden. His friends, who have been with him for several years, are just a few yards away. They slumber underneath the star-filled sky. They still don't know that even though they sleep, the world is about to wake. 11 of 12 men sleep beside a hill. One man awake. He couldn't sleep, for he knew. He was in a garden, in prayer, praying so hard about what he knew was about to come, praying so hard that blood actually dripped from his pores in a place of sweat. Back at the hill, when he returned, he begged his friends to wake and pray with him. They didn't know how serious his request really was. They had no idea what was just to come. He pleaded with his friends, "Why will you not rise and pray with me?" He asked this again before returning to the garden alone. He knelt there on rocky soil, his hands clasped, his head bowed. Twilight dew draped his neck, the horizon still in black. He prayed even harder, for the sky would eventually turn purple, then light blue, and he knew what awaited him. Back to the hill once more, his friends asleep. He begged his friends, rise and pray with me. I need you now more than ever. They said they would, but shortly after he left, they fell asleep again. The dawn was even closer, and he knew his time was running out. Now over the hill, they marched like flowing lava burning in the night's solace. The 11 are surely awake now. They have sworn their faith to him. But he knows, he knew this wasn't true. They'll weaken and he'll be forsaken. Forsaken by the same men who just swore their undying devotion. The torchlights grow brighter, the hourglass running low. The clanging of the metal swords and spears, the sound and the vibration of the march deep down from their feet to their spine, creating a shallow vibration, leaving them quivering. The soldiers approach.
the one is grabbed and kissed. Betrayed with a kiss. A kiss wearing the mask of loyalty. One of the men leaps forward, draws his sword, cutting the ear off one of the soldiers. He raises his hand. No. Peace. Take me now in peace. For this is my purpose. This is my being. This is the reason I came. Now, one of them, Peter, strays. While his friend is being persecuted for crimes he didn't commit, he stands by a fire, denying any relationship he has as he tries to blend in with the common people. A woman approaches.
Didn't I see you with him?
Peter says,
surely I don't know him, but you're from Galilee.
For the third time, Peter says,
I do not know this man.
Now Jesus is pulled back and forth between the two who will determine his fate. They can't see any crime, but they still question, scourge, and mock him.
Aren't you the king?
Silence.
Then here is your crown,
says one as they give him a crown of thorns and press it into his head. He stands before the judge, who could condemn him for no crime, but it is Passover. He says to the crowd,
You can choose. One I will release. Him as the king of the Jews, or...
Jesus, standing silent, his eyes to the ground, is condemned to death. Jesus now carries his cross through the stone-clad streets to the place known as the Skull, the place where he will soon die. His back torn, his head bleeding beneath his thorny crown. The women cry out loud as he passes. He pauses for a moment and comforts them. Do not weep for me. Rather, weep for yourselves. His mother looks on as huge nails are driven through his hands and his feet. They raise the cross and slam it into the ground. It is at this point that all four writers of the gospel struggled with a description of the crucifixion, as I have. They described with the only words that I could use. And they crucified him. He now hung on the cross as the soldiers bid lots on his clothing below. Next to him, two criminals hang, but they are simply tied to the cross. One of them says,
You're the Son of God. Save us now. Save all of us.
The man in the middle does nothing, for he had a purpose. The afternoon passes. His skin stretched. He wept. He begged for water, and they gave him a sponge on a reed filled with vinegar. In a moment where he showed us that he was truly human, he cried out and said, my father, why have you forsaken me? The sky began to grow dark. It was approaching 3 o'clock. On a Friday afternoon, when Jesus, the carpenter from Nazareth, spoke once more and only once. His last words, "It is finished." So today, people all over the world, do as I do now. I thank that lone carpenter for dying on that Friday afternoon, so I may live.
Glenn Beck.